That's why the leadership element is the difference maker. You know, you can take two organizations or two teams of equal ability, put them side by side. The team that will win in any sphere you want to look at is the one that has the best leader.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. This is episode number 20 and today we are delighted to be joined by Drew Povey. Many of you will remember Drew from Educating Manchester, now in its second season with the original airing in 2017. He has a multi-sector viewpoint on creating innovation and sustainable change, and with over 20 years experience in elite level sport, education and business, his leadership consultancy promotes people, performance and potential. He is widely read and author of two books, Educating Drew and The Leadership Factor. A renowned public speaker on all things leadership, he has had a number of articles published in Forbes and is shortly to release his new blog, Leadership in the Remote World. So now, over to the podcast.
So before we jump into the conversation with Drew Povey, I just wanted to share an exciting competition that John and I have got to share with you, our lovely listeners. So 2020 hasn't been the year that any of us expected, but that doesn't mean that you can't get 2021 off to a flying start, and we're hoping this competition is going to be the way that you can do that. We are giving the chance for 5 lucky listeners to win free coaching sessions in January to help you get 2021 off to the best start. The way you can enter this competition is super simple. Go to our website, it's scaffoldcoaching.com. That's scaffoldcoaching.com. And right there in the middle of the homepage is a button that says enter the competition. That's all you need to do. Click on that button, fill in the form, tell us a brief description about the goal that you would like to achieve in 2021. And you're in the draw to hopefully win some free coaching sessions in 2021. Good luck, everybody. So hi, Drew, and welcome to the podcast. We are super grateful to have you give up your time today to speak to us. And I'm hoping that our listeners are really going to find this really, really interesting, because there's a lot more to you in terms of the leadership sphere than what we see in the press, particularly. So I'm going to let you do the introduction of yourself. If you wouldn't mind just talking us through, how does somebody go from being a head teacher to now being a leadership coach with a really successful consultancy business?
So I'll be careful, because these can be really boring, these introductions when people talk about themselves. But basically, the best way to describe it, I think, is I'm a leadership geek and I love everything about leadership, and I have been fascinated about it for years. I saw lots of connections between sports coaching and teaching and leadership. I think they were all trying to do the same thing. I saw all these crossovers, but I didn't see people sharing ideas across those various sectors. So I just became fascinated by it. I suppose I'm quite a curious person. And if I was good at DIY, which my wife will testify I'm not at all, she seriously wouldn't let me hang a picture. She won't even let me do the gardening. That's how bad I am. I'd be one of those people that would be taking like radios and stuff to pieces and trying to work out how they worked, because I can't do that. I'm more interested in doing that with humans, I suppose, not literally taking them to pieces, just to be clear for your listeners. But it's more about actually how people are wired up, why people do what they do in kind of all walks of life. So it was intriguing for me, for a student in a school, why they were doing what they were doing, whether that was good or bad. I wanted to find out why. For an athlete on a sports field, why they would be successful or not successful or feeling stuck, and why for a business leader, why they might be doing well or not doing well. I just want to get behind the eyes of it and try and understand it, and then try and help people to get to better levels of performance in whatever realm that is.
Is it all that stuff about human behavior then, really, Drew? We are infinitely complicated beings, aren't we? And is it the whole of that how complicated it is, and how does it all fit together?
I think so, yeah. I mean, human beings are weird, aren't we? Like for example, yeah. we can sit in a situation and we know what's happening. It's like we can see this car crash coming in front of us, but this thing called emotions just grab hold of us and we do that stupid thing that we know we just shouldn't do. And like, you know, we all do that in life. And I find myself doing that and I observe other people doing it. Yeah, it's fascinating to look at why we behave the way we do. Why do we think the way we do when a lot of the time it just doesn't make sense? But of course, life can be tough as well, you know, and it's, I suppose it's giving people some tools and some tactics that actually work, not as just been talked about in a book somewhere or studied somewhere, giving people something that they can actually use to be able to help them navigate through life as best they can. And that's more than just surviving, you know, let's not just get through here. Let's actually do something brilliant. As Steve Jobs said, let's make a dent in the universe. I think I haven't come across anybody yet that's absolutely hit their potential. So there's always something more to give. So come on, let's work out what's going on and let's see what are those trigger points. What are those things we can unlock to get somebody to be the best that they can possibly be?
Amazing. So you left the head teacher role and you've now got a company called Drew Povey Consultancy. Just tell our listeners, how do you go from being the head teacher to the consultancy and a bit of the about the kind of clients that you're working with and the bit of the, just give us the context of the kind of work that you're doing to uncover this human potential.
Yeah, so a lot of people go, it's really interesting how you've done that. And I go, not by design, by accident. I just happen to be interested in this stuff. And the more I was writing of this stuff and kind of I had it up in my office, more people were coming in going, that's quite interesting. What does that mean? Or would you come and speak to us about that? Or people would ring up and say, have you got anything on this? And very quickly, I started to see that it would work in all sectors. Because where I was interested is that, you know, if something worked in sport, where I started off, would that work in a classroom? And I've obviously found out that it did work. But then would that same idea, maybe more nuanced, work in a business setting? So this was all kind of going on. And of course, we made lots of money for the school by the governors pretty much pimping me out to go and do talks in the various sectors. And I just built up a network of people and I was giving stuff to them saying, you know, because I was passionate about it, go out, play with this, try it, see if it works. You know, tell me where it's not working, snag it and let's make it better. And working with people on these models, we kind of started to refine them and get them better. And then from leaving education, it was just a seamless path into the world of business. And most of the work I do now, I'm still hugely privileged to work across the five sectors that I've always worked in. So still doing a lot in elite sport. And love the people I work with there. And elite sport is just so pure in so many ways about, you know, team working and high level performance. And then still working with some brilliant schools, some fantastic head teachers and leadership teams and seeing what works there. And exactly the same with the police, you know, seeing how the police do what they do. And I have so much respect for the police because they deal with so much negativity. I mean, think about what they're dealing with nearly all day, every day. That's a negative thing. You know, working with people in the NHS. I mean, talk about making something work that shouldn't. You know, the people in there, that's not a career, it's a calling. I mean, my goodness, those people are quite literally saving lives every day. And what people are doing in business is incredible. And the reasons why they're doing what they're doing in business and getting behind the eyes of that. So it's been really exciting. Still working in the five sectors and plugging these ideas in and then getting some great feedback on them. But of course, all the time, the whole business is about helping people develop, which is why I started coaching, why I went into teaching, why I, you know, started to get involved in leadership and why we do what we do now. It's always been about helping people. And of course, at the start of COVID, we felt a real passion that our core purpose could be used for good in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been, you know, obviously following you for a while and I've listened to a lot of your podcasts and I know you love The Power of Three and I know you love matching letters, but it really seems to me that things
you've worked me out.
What I think I've been really struck with is the commonality between the people that you work for, the causes. It seems to be there needs to be the passion of the people in there. There needs to be purpose to the work. And then, and I think this comes across in some of the podcasts where you've talked about your early life, this persistence, like this, that people need to persist in what they're doing. And I think when you get all those three, you seem to be really motivated and ignited by a project. And I think that's what we see across sport, NHS, education. I mean, I might be on the wrong, am I kind of in the right vein there?
Yeah, 100% right. You know, people have got to care. You know, I am drawn towards people that really care about what they do. You know, they really give a damn, because, you know, there are times in life when we're just kind of just floating along, sailing along, just kind of in that mediocre mainstream that Seth Godin talks about. And life's got to be more than that. You know, we're not on the earth that long, and we've got to find the thing that ignites us, the thing that excites us, the thing that gets us up out of bed in the morning. And I'm not suggesting everyone springs out of bed like Tigger every single morning and is excited by what they do. But I think that caring that people have, I am automatically drawn towards. I'm also really interested in people who might be going through a tough time, you know, about how do we navigate that? Because the argument would be, you know, how much support do you need when it's going well? Well, my view on that is actually you still need support, because we should always be continuing to improve. But I think there's a great call to be able to help people. And there's, you know, there's times in life when we've all needed help, and I've needed help personally, I've needed help professionally, and I've relied on other people that have said, I'll help you. Yeah. I'll be there for you. Here's some advice for you. I'll give up my time. I'll be there to give you something that can be important, that might help you through this. And I love Edgar Schein's stuff that he's written on helping people. And we forget, you know, as human beings, we sometimes say human beings are selfish people. You know, we just look after our own. And yeah, of course, there are examples of selfish behavior. But if the last few months during COVID has taught us anything, it has taught us that people are willing to help. You know, people will go to a neighbor and say, do you want me to do some shopping? People have started local radio stations up to help people get through this difficult time. People are reaching out. Human beings like to help. I did a post on this that actually went a lot better than I thought it would. I thought it would just be something I believed in, that some people would go, well, what's this guy rabbiting on about? But it was about that idea of when you stop and ask someone for directions when you're lost, people are always willing to help. I've never genuinely had anybody tell me where to go or I'm not interested. People will write it down on a piece of paper. People have even offered to jump in my car and help me get to that place, which is probably a bit dangerous and scary. So there needs to be a health warning with that. But people like to help. And I think we forget that there. And I think that's a really important part of life. We don't get through any of this stuff on our own. Good times or bad times, you know, good times we stand on the shoulder of giants, bad times, life's a team sport. So it's about all of that, people caring, helping. And there is that bit that you've mentioned there that is quite hard to articulate, but, you know, we have to keep going. Even during COVID, we've had to keep going, and it's been difficult at times, but one foot in front of the other, head down, keep moving. You know, those kind of messages, I believe, are crucial, because we all hit various points in our life and we've all got to look for that help and that support from somewhere. And I think that messaging and those people around us can be pretty damn crucial.
I think you hit it right at the head of the show, really, Drew, when you talked about being curious. You know, you can't do any of this stuff and there are quite a lot of people out there who think that they know it all and they've got the answer. You know, you have to have this like curious nature, I think, to start with. And that's how, you know, you work well, isn't it, across all those different sectors that you're working with. How can people learn from one another? They can't if they aren't curious.
Yeah, I mean, it is about connecting the dots. It's like a big game of dot to dot when you're looking across leadership sectors. Curiosity for me is such a big term in so many ways. I just don't think we get curious enough. I think sometimes we get the first answer and we go, oh, thank goodness I've got an answer, we'll move on. No. Let's dig down a bit more. Is that first answer the best answer? Don't know. But let's keep being curious and finding out what we're actually dealing with here. That for me is huge. I also think that I was talking to someone earlier today about this, in that I've done a number of talks on the fact that curiosity for me is the hidden gem in resilience. You know, a lot of the resilience stuff talks about, okay, you're going to get knocked down, just get up and go again. You know, we talk about, it's probably not politically correct, but we talk about manning up and going again, or womaning up, or whatever we want to call it. We just talk about get up and go again. But how can you go again smarter? Well, you've got to get curious.
I think it's without doing the very things that just got you to where you are. Yeah,
exactly. Because, you know, just getting knocked down, going again, getting knocked down, going again, knocked down, going again. That's not resilience. That's stupidity. The chances are you're going to make the same mistake again. Mm. And of course, as we say in schools, you know, if you keep making the same mistake, it's not really a mistake anymore. It's a choice.
Yeah.
And we have to reframe that.
So also the curiosity to find the meaning in it from a resilience point of view as well, and to explore the bigger picture and perhaps be a little bit more inquisitive to that kind of a thing as well. So I really like that.
Yeah, I mean, you need to dig for it, and it will take time, and it will be frustrating, and it won't be easy, but you've got to push yourself to keep going down the layers. Because eventually you will get to, you know, I know Simon Sinek talks about start with why, and I think that's a useful concept. My concern is sometimes that why can be quite superficial. You know, you see a core purpose of a business and you're almost going, well, what does that mean? And you look at the staff and they don't know what it means, but they've got a core purpose, as Jim Collins would say, so life's all good. No, let's dig down even more and understand why that is powerful, or I would say the ultimate why. What's the ultimate why behind what you're doing? And when that resonates, well, that's when I think you can hit that real sweet spot and drive forward.
Yeah, we do a lot of work with them businesses where we help them find their core purpose, but then I think what a lot of businesses and leaders forget to do is find a way to connect that core purpose to the individual's why.
Yeah.
And however tenuous that link is, you have to do it, otherwise they will never connect in a way that it can become a collective why.
Exactly. It just becomes a slogan,
yeah,
or something that's on the wall and they go, oh, that's what we stand for. What does that mean? I don't know, but it's just what we stand for.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the old saying, isn't it? If that's powerful, then it means you stand for something. Because if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. So you've really, really got to dig down and go, what is it we're standing for? And when you get that, that's when you get a sports team just going bigger and better than anyone thought possible. That's when you get a kid that will absolutely smash through any of the challenges they've got in life. That's when you're going to get a business to go next gen. This is when you see people get to the next level because they wholeheartedly believe in it. We forget the power of the belief. A slogan ain't going to do it. But when you dig down and you get the ultimate why, and that stands for something, that means something, that connects to your belief, then wow, human beings can literally achieve almost anything.
Yeah, definitely. I think we get a little bit too distracted nowadays. It's all too easy, isn't it? I think with kids, I think with adults, I think with people in business, you're too distracted doing stuff to really, it's not enough to just have a why, like you say, like what Simon Sinek does, and you've got the slogan. You need to dig into it regularly and reconnect, because otherwise you're just busy doing stuff and distraction leads to falling for anything, right?
Exactly that. Yeah. And I think you're right, actually, about revisiting it. Because you've got to keep going back. You've got to keep reminding yourself why. And that's what the best leaders do. They're going, let's not forget what we're here to do. Let's not forget what we're here. Let's not forget what we're talking about here. Let's not forget what we signed up to. Because you've got to keep pulling people back to that. Otherwise, people will forget. I was listening to Patrick Lencioni the other week. He's one of my favourite authors.
We're massive fans, aren't we?
Okay. So he was brilliant. And he was talking about leaders have to over-communicate their message. And he said, you know, so many leaders say something once, it's on a slide deck on a website, and then they think job done. And he tells this great story. He said, it's a bit like my wife saying to me, Pat, obviously it's Patrick Lencioni saying this, Pat, do you still love me? And me looking at her, looking a bit confused, saying the words, I told you I loved you on our wedding day. And if things change, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? It's so true, because we do this in business. We do this in our organizations, in our schools, in our sports teams. We set it up, but we don't over communicate it. People need regular reminders, and we need to find lots of different ways of saying that thing, of connecting that thing to something more than just a job, something more than just a career. Let's get people to see their work as a calling. And that's when it starts getting exciting.
Exactly. And you know what, to build on that, it's not just saying it every day. It must be a theme at the minute, because Simon Sinek last night on his Infinite Game talked about you need to over communicate because you tell your husband or wife that you love them every day. But to take it a step forward, it's not just saying it, it's showing it. You know, it's making them a cup of tea. It's doing those little things that remind them of the fact that you're together and that you care for each other. And how, as a leader, are you demonstrating that, but also communicating that? And I think we forget it. We really do.
And that's why the leadership element is the difference maker. You know, you can take two organizations or two teams of equal ability, put them side by side. The team that will win in any sphere you want to look at is the one that has the best leader, because they're going to be exemplifying those behaviors. They're going to be over communicating their message, and they're going to be working. This is basically about what I refer to as belief banks. We all have a belief bank, okay? And every day we can either take withdrawals or add credits to that belief bank, and it can either build or it can shrink. And a leader's job, through their behaviors, through the words they use, through the way they connect to the business, they're building those belief banks up, and they're wanting to be adding credits all the time, using loads of strategies, whether it's team strategy stuff, whether it's positive psychology, whether it's communication tools, whether it's trust building. They're finding lots of ways to add credits to that belief bank. And as those beliefs increase in size, well, that's when, again, the magic happens.
Absolutely. Speaking about whys and purposes, now I know you're all about the people, but having followed and listened to a lot of your stuff and read a lot of your stuff, I secretly think you might be a little bit of a secret academic. I could see you doing a PhD, you know, or something like.
Give over.
No, I honestly, I was listening. We'll put some podcasts in the show notes where you go into. You know, you, on a lot of other podcasts, you've told the story that you weren't the most academic child, not the brightest button, should we say, but your persistence and your interest. But I've just been sat here listening now, and I mean, John's very like this. You can recite any book you've ever read. You have this incredible ability to remember models and people that you've read. And I'm like, where does that come from? Because this is what academics are made of.
So I'm dyslexic, which was revealed in the TV show. A lot of people have reached out to me about that, and I didn't know I was dyslexic. So this is the first time I've talked about it on a podcast, but it was, I didn't know till I was a teacher and I was in dyslexic training or training for dyslexia. And I'm sitting there going, that's me. I do that. Hold on a minute. That's me.
So at this age, you found out that you're dyslexic?
Well, at 24. I'd like to say this age, but 24, put the numbers round the other way and you're probably a bit closer. I was advised by a really good mate of mine to start doing audiobooks. And I was like, well, yeah, because like reading, I can read, of course, but it's slow. So I started doing audiobooks, and then I'd remember what I'd listened to, and then I'd make notes on that. So there's files and files down here and files on my notes, and I just type out the things that I've learned. So, yeah, I can remember those things. And doing a PhD, like, I have nothing against academia at all. I mean, gosh, I had 18 glorious years in education. I just don't know what it would do. I'm one of these people that, again, will go, well, why? Why would I need to do that? Okay, so I could do it. But I could spend the time writing a book that more people could read that would help more people. So actually, I'm really attuned to my why, which is helping people develop. Now, if I could do a PhD that would really help people develop, then yeah, I would probably see the purpose behind it and drive to do it. But because it doesn't, I kind of go, well, what's the point? Like, and I'm not disrespecting PhDs. I speak on master's courses. I've spoken on MBAs. You know, I'm really interested in the whole world of academia. I've got some great friends who are professors. It is not about that. It's about, can it deliver the mission I think I can do, which is help people to develop? And I'm not sure whether it would. Now, maybe in time, I might go, I think it might do, you know, so therefore I might do it. But yeah, that's how it all sticks in my head, because my brain works differently. And that's why I can create a model and I can connect dots. So I was working with somebody recently and we just observed the team together. And I was like, yeah, there's an issue there. We need to do that. We'll do this with them. And they were just like, well, we're like, all right, Rain Man, how have you come out with that? And I was like, well, it's just obvious, isn't it? And it was a joy to me to do. My brain felt on fire, genuinely. I felt like, you know, I could have done this all day. I'm completely in the Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi flow state, where I was completely in that moment and present and was loving every second of it. But this person was like going, wow, how have you seen that? That's just how my brain works. So yes, I might read and write a bit slower than some people, but I can connect things. I can create things. And that's how I've been able to generate models that I think will help people. Then I give them to people and people play around with them and they come back and they go, hey, it's all right, this, Drew. I think you might have something here. And then we work on it together and we craft it even further.
Isn't that incredible? See, I've even made an assumption there that I've been pulled upon, you see, because we normally assume that, you know, reading your books and some of the papers that you've done, it's normally academics that have the time because they're doing the PhD to do that. But what I think I love about your models is they are a little bit different in that you can tell that they are baked in reality. So that makes sense now that you've actually observed something going on in the business context and then you found the time to actually write up the model.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were doing the PhD, you would just be almost given the permission to research and find.
I've been helped by loads of people and I kind of almost felt it going into two camps, and these are not discrete camps. There is crossover, but I found that some of it was heavily academic that had been studied and rigorously meta-analysis and whatever, blind placebo doubled, whatever. And it was like really, really good data stuff that you could use. Then there was some other people who I learned from that was literally had like learned on the job and had these little tools and tactics that they could kind of do, but it wasn't really backed in much research. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could kind of cross the two over? And I remember I was doing, it was a Red Brick University. I won't say which one it was, only because I've not checked. I'm sure they wouldn't mind. But I was doing their business professors at a session on leadership. And the feedback they gave me was, we really like your stuff because it was based in academia. You will quote people, but actually it was really plug and play, which is the phrase I use. We could, there's something we can pick up here and do tomorrow. There's actually something we can go into our jobs and actually put that in place, not have to have this 3-year strategy with. And that's what I've always tried to do. I'll give you something to really think about, hopefully. But at the same time, there's something you can do tomorrow morning, because when I was a leader, well, I suppose in many ways I still am a leader, but throughout my leadership life, I've wanted some quick tips as well, some things that I can go and play with. So I've always tried to bolt those two things together. So in all of the models I make and bake, I try and get them to be those two things amalgamated. And then when I do a keynote, I try and make it those two things. And also for the audience as well, you know, there will be some people in there going, I want to know the research, pal. Shut up with your little gimmicks. I want to know the research, pal. And there's other people going like, not bothered about the research. Listen, I've got a bit of a job on my hands here. What can I do tomorrow morning when I go? In fact, I want it tonight when I go on the phone call after I've finished it. What can you give me that's going to help me right now? So I'm hoping that someone will come to a session and go, wherever you are, whatever you want, there'll be something in there for you. And again, I want to help those people. So that's the reason why it's been kind of put together the way it has been.
Just for our listeners that are perhaps not familiar with some of your models or have not read your books or your articles, give us an example of one of your models and then how it fits.
Okay.
Give us a real life example or a story where it's come from.
So beginning of COVID, we all thought we were going to die, didn't we? If we're being honest, we go back to Marvel, like this is the end of humanity as we know it.
This was Hollywood. What Hollywood has been telling us is going to happen. This is Independence Day.
Armageddon. It's Armageddon. Now, as an RE teacher, I had loads of little quotes. I had Revelation open every day.
Yeah.
But it was a time when we just didn't know. So we were like, right, how many people can we help? And we've never been interested in money. And people go, well, yeah, that's all right. You know, the leadership world's well paid, and it is well paid, but we've never done things for the money. We've done it for the work and the passion of the work that we talked about earlier. So we just said, let's help as many people as we can during this period. So I reached out to loads of contacts and we were working with different people, and they were very generous. They, of course, they were paying us, but we did lots of work in elite sport and like with the Welsh Rugby Union, we did some talks there, and we were doing, I did some stuff with TikTok, which was just brilliant. They were just fabulous. You know, 400 people have been recruited since February, I think, something like that. And then they'd never met each other. It was just like, it was just an incredible, just going across different tech businesses and all kinds of stuff. So there was a lot going on. I thought, what could I produce right now that I think would help people? Because a lot of people were having to make really quick decisions. So I thought, let's go back to the research on thinking. How do we make decisions? And then I started reading this stuff and I was going, oh my goodness. I mean, do you two know how many decisions we make a day on average? And by the way, nobody can really make the mind up, because it depends how you...
Like 10,000 or something.
Yeah, probably on average, I'd say 10,000.
Yeah.
But only 40 of them are in our, like, conscious...
Stream of conscious, your conscious competence stuff.
Yeah, I'm reading the Trint Paradox again at the minute, so I'm in
Steve
that.
Peters. Yeah, good old thing. So I was looking at this, and have you read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow?
I have. I love Daniel Kahneman.
We're just talking about it this morning.
Were you? Brilliant. I love this stuff, right? So I'm looking at, if we're making roughly 10,000 decisions a day, I mean, somewhere between 2,500 and 35,000 is what the research says. Yeah. We're making a lot of decisions. But then you look at the fast thinking, which is system one.
Yeah.
You've got intuitive.
Yeah.
And then your system two, your slower thinking.
Yeah.
Are we deciding which of those decisions, like, you know, which underpants are you wearing today? Don't really matter. What are you having for breakfast? Don't really matter. We can use system one. But for system two, have we got a way of slowing our thinking down? Because in COVID, what I noticed was people had no differentiation between their work and their home, because their home was their work. I don't say work and life, by the way, because work should be a part of your life, and that's great. And we should love work, so it should be a part of our life. So I say work and home. And the problem is that there was no differentiation because we were working from home. So there was no beginning and end to a day. So I was getting really concerned about, when were we making the best decisions? And was there a way in which we could slow our thinking down? We also became uber contactable. So, like, if I sent you an email and you didn't respond for 3 days, no one would really care. Whereas now people are expecting an email back within 10 minutes because, well, you're sitting at home, what's wrong with you? And then people were checking their emails in the evening. And so I said, right, how can we get a way of getting people to slow down and think deeply when they need to think deeply? So the first thing I started to do is, we just need to pause. Everyone's living 100 miles an hour. Pause. And I have this little brain rant. So I'm reading all the stuff I've read on pause. Kevin Cashman's pause principle, the power of just taking a moment to be in the moment. Rob Poynton, I'm fortunate enough to have shared the stage with Rob. He's the side business professor from Oxford. He wrote a book called Do Pause, and he says, when we pause, we get more creative. Love that. Stillness is the Key by Ryan Holiday. Great book about, actually, if we take a moment, or we look at the great minds throughout history, they did pause. So I started going, right, we need to find ways of pausing. And then once we've paused, which hopefully will get us away from system one thinking, off the hamster wheel, off the treadmill, we can then start to get perspective. So I started looking at, how can we see things? Because we live life at such a pace, we're almost this close. How do we get people to zoom out? How do we get different perspective on something? How do we get the bird's eye view? Then the more I looked at this and the more I was sharing it with people, it was like, it's not just our perspective. We've got to get perspectives. So I put an S in brackets, because we should be talking to other people, because just because I see it this way, confirmation bias and cognitive bias, they might not see it this way. So actually, we need to get perspectives. So if we do pause and we get that powerful be present, then we can get creative because we're pausing. Then we get perspectives. Then and only then can we start to set the priorities, which will allow us to do that system two thinking and start to ask questions like, what matters most now? So yes, it is the rule of three, and they all do begin with P. So I followed the usual thing, but it makes a very simple mind. And the reason I think it works is because education's got a bad reputation in some ways for taking the incredibly simple and making it ludicrously complex. And I try and do the other way with leadership, where I take some complex stuff and make it simple. If we can pause, if we can get perspective and the perspectives of others, then we can really set the priorities and make some good decisions. And what was interesting about this model, the more I worked on it with people, they were starting to go, do you know what, Drew, this is great. We can do that for an hour a week. But then I started working in elite sport with some sports teams. And I was saying, well, why can't you do it in 30 seconds? Well, we can't pause, get perspective and separate. Well, why not? When a try's been scored or conceded, when a goal's been scored or conceded, you might have 60 to 90 seconds. Isn't that enough time to get people in to pause? Let's have a minute, guys. Here, girls, let's have a minute. Okay, what do we think? What's going on? Get the perspectives. What do we need to do now? What matters most now? Set the priorities. Or you can spend 10 days doing it, like Bill Gates still does. He goes away, doesn't he, for 10 years, and he presses pause on his life, and that's when he gets his best ideas. So he pauses, perspective, priorities over 10 days. And even in meetings, when we're stuck on Zoom meetings all day, I think just 15 seconds before the meeting starts, you can do those three Ps. And I think it can get people into a deeper level of thinking. And the more people I've shared it with, the more people are going, do you know what, Drew, this has really helped us in a time when we could constantly be system one thinking, which is pretty superficial.
I think that's really interesting. You think about when you apply that then, Drew, to actually making critical decisions, what you've talked about there with those three Ps is getting to a point where you're about to make a decision, if you like. Have you ever sort of employed the idea that you would have decision-making rules to suit the situation? So you might say if we had a strategic decision to make, we would always agree to do that in a way that all of us were involved. So it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's a shared collective decision making rule. But there may be different other decisions to be made in the business that don't need that and don't require it. Have you ever used this idea that you set these different decision making rules for different circumstances?
I mean, with teams, definitely. We'd say, is this a system two or is this a system one? Can we bash this out quick? Do we need to really discuss it? What's interesting is when you do the pause and perspective, you normally get partway through the perspective and realize you can make it pretty quickly. So you can still do the three Ps, but you just go through them a lot quicker. Yeah. It's only when you start to get the perspectives do you realize whether it's got to go deeply into system two, which of course it can do. And then you might set another meeting. So that's when people will get onto this in a meeting and go, I think we need a separate meeting for this, because this is a bigger decision than we realize. But you only get that in the perspectives bit. The other bit that I kind of add on at the end is some potholes and pitfalls. And again, this was just through kind of snagging it with individual leaders I was working with. You know, we've got to remember confirmation bias.
Yeah.
We have to remember that. You know, we are not unbiased individuals. We will see things in line with our preconceptions.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at doing those three Ps, we will be leaning towards a certain way because that's what we believe in and we want to be right. Talk a lot about the recency effect, you know, which is the last thing that you hear, and the primacy effect, the first thing that you hear. So these two are interesting because sometimes when you're in a mess and you're going, oh, we don't know what to do, and someone comes out with an idea, you fall in love with that idea and the person that came out with the idea. Like, we've got some, we're all right, we've got some. And then sometimes that's where it stops. But then the recency effect is the last thing that's talked about is very often the thing that people remember. So people lean towards that. We have to be aware of groupthink as well, which is a massive one. And the other big one, I would say, we have to be aware of decision fatigue. Particularly in this world, like, you know, I am a serious blob in the evenings. I mean, like, I come in and my wife's like, what do you want to do tonight? What, you know, what do you want to do this weekend? I'm like, I don't know, whatever. Just like, leave me by the nose, I'll go and do it. And I was talking to a group of leaders about 5 years ago, and I was saying, I'm just useless at night. You know, I'm just like, I can do stuff in the day with people. And they were like, yeah, but have you read about decision fatigue? And I was like, no, what is this thing? So of course, being me, I went away and read about it. I was like, oh my goodness, we only have a limited amount of decision-making ability every day.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because that was one of my first observations when I was a leader in the corporate world, and I was very conscious that the CEOs worked for a big telco, Vodafone, big CEOs, and the CMO and the CEO, all they do all day is make decisions. So when people come to them and say, there's three options, 1, 2, and 3, make the decision, I just started going, I've got a couple of, there's a few options, I think it's this one, here's why. I would stop preventing them from having to make another decision.
Yeah.
And I just found that was what got me noticed. Yeah, it's really funny. And I always remember the CMO saying, all I do all day is make decisions. It's so nice to be able to sit and have a discussion around a decision that's already been made.
Yeah, and I think you have to remember why people do that. People don't want to cock it up.
No.
Yeah. People don't want to make mistakes. Yeah, exactly. And people love to be able to do this thing called responsibility transfer.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you the responsibility and you can make the call on it, and that's off my plate. What happens is, the higher you go up, these kind of decision-making plates are literally overflowing. Mm. And if we haven't got an unlimited resource, like the well is going to run dry at some point, we need to be really careful about this, because there's going to become times in a day when we're going to make some pretty crappy decisions.
What do you think then, Drew, in terms of, how do we help people maintain like the discipline to keep not just reacting to system one and thinking and pressing pause, getting perspective, setting those priorities? How do you get people to keep that discipline up?
I think it's a team thing. I think if everybody's aware of it, you know, this is not just about one leader going, right, everyone, we need to press pause, and someone's we're going to contemplate our navel. I think everybody's got to buy into this. I really do. And I think a lot of this is being self-aware as well. So what can happen in life is, you know, do we know when we're at our best? I'm a morning person. Like I'm much better in the morning. I'm going to make better decisions in the morning. I know that. Now, that doesn't mean I don't make any decisions and I don't do a podcast in the afternoon or whatever, but I would much prefer to do it in the morning, because that's where I'm at my sharpest. Other people, these are the chronotype stuff that Daniel Pink talks about. That's like in the afternoon for some people. My older brother, he's an afternoon guy.
Yeah.
So it's knowing, I think, yourself.
Yeah.
For
it's
sure.
Knowing when you nail it. According to some of the latest research from Harvard, a guy called Isaac Hankel, he reckons we've only got 2.5 hours of high performance focus a day.
Oh, I didn't know that. I 100% believe that.
I don't reckon I've got that. Right? I reckon I'm scraping the barrel at about an hour and a half.
I am.
And we, you do.
have you read When by Daniel Pink?
No, I haven't.
Oh, but honestly, it's just brilliant. He's like, it's so obvious, but it's brilliant. So he there's so many good examples in there. Like, one is, like, we know that teenagers, for example, like, do not really wake up till like half 10, 11 o'clock.
So why do we teach the maths at 9 a.m?
Yeah, like, seriously, it's like every school, there are a couple of schools, I think there's one up in the northeast that starts later on, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
He talks about that they did some studies on decisions made by judges in courtrooms. And he said the worst time where they got most of the decisions wrong was just before lunchtime. So you're like, everyone's bricking it. If you're going up in court and it's just before lunch, you're going, oh no, this is not good. So I think it's about being aware. Timing. So if there's one thing, I mean, who the hell am I to argue with Simon Sinek? I've already said, I think you've got to go down to the ultimate why, not just the why. But I also think on his golden circle, it's what, how, ultimate why for me, but I think there needs to be a when in there. Timing is crucial. There's not many people I come across in business, right, that have crap ideas, but when they choose to do them, it's the timing of those ideas that are really important. And there's a lot of good luck in timing. You know, Jurgen Klopp coming to the Premier League, you know, when Pep Guardiola had this stranglehold and we thought this could be like a Man United 10-year job, but he came in at the right time with his style at the right time. there's a lot to do with timing. I think that's a great book. And I take a lot of that for ourselves. Do we know when we're at our best? Do we know when those high performance focus hours are? And you'll probably get another couple of hours, which reaches into your 6-hour workday. Yeah. You'll get another couple of hours. But I read a book recently called The New Corner Office, which is about like the working from home agenda. And it was saying, if you're going to be working from home and that is your new corner office, just be clear that you don't work to time.
Yeah.
You should work to task. Yeah. You can't do both. And it's saying, if you're going to be trying to do all of this, you're going to end up all over the place. Get in, work to task, do what you need to do to the highest ability. Now, I would add on to that and know when that time is best for you, whether you're a lark or an owl or whatever. And that is when I think you're going to get people in the strength zones, in the sweet spot, and producing the best work.
And as a leader, knowing what's best for your team and that it's not the same as you, because you can't hold other people to the same standard that you're at. You know, you might be a morning person, same as me, but somebody else.
So have you heard of the platinum? You've probably heard of the golden rule. Do unto others as you had done unto you. Have you heard of the platinum rule?
Yes.
So that is do unto others as they'd have done to them.
Yeah.
Because the golden rule, I always felt this, right? Growing up.
Literally, he's got written on it on the
wall.
We were talking about it. It's like, it's literally there. It says, treat people how you want to be treated. And I'm like, I never say this. I go with the Myers-Briggs and I say, do not treat people how you want to be treated. Treat people how they expect to be treated.
Yeah, how they want it. So I was listening to, honestly, it's a true story. I was working with a big company and it was an annual awards ceremony and they got this lady up on stage to go, oh my goodness, she's been amazing. And the look on her face, I was like, she's not happy about this. And they were all like, oh, she'll be chuffed to bits. And she wasn't. And then it came out a couple of months later that she did not want to be. If she'd have been sent a nice hamper to her house and quietly said, hey, you've nailed it here, kid. Nice one. That would have been amazing, but that's not what happened. They treated her as they would want to be treated, the glitz and glamour of the big stage. This was a couple of years ago now. So that, I think, is really crucial for leaders. You know, just because you like it don't mean everybody else does. And this comes down to how well do you know your team? So this is, of course, in the Daniel Goleman emotional intelligence, you've got self-awareness and then you've got self-management. But then you've got social awareness. That is like everything else around you and how people are. And then that relationship management is the top level. And it's about going up through one and two, know yourself, manage yourself. But then it's about knowing other people and helping manage other people and working with them. I don't think you can manage people, actually. You have to lead them, because in this world, they can just tell you where to go, can't they? But you've got to lead them into a better place. And that only comes from your knowledge of who they are and what they need.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the things that leaders can probably ask as a question of people that they lead is, how can I help you? And how many times do people do that? They don't even think about doing it because they're the leader. But if they could just take some perspective, as you're saying there, is that that is a wonderful thing to say to somebody. And for them to feel comfortable in actually giving them the answer.
And
that
how
they want.
Do you work best and how can I help with that? Do you know what you've got me thinking about? That I really think your model, the three Ps, is a really nice addition to this system one and system two thinking. And I need to take this away actually after this conversation and think about it, because we were briefed this morning on some work around inclusivity. And I actually wonder if there's an extension of it to that, because you know, how you explain it, then you think, if you just pause and think about your own biases as an individual, because we all have them, we all make assumptions, we all have biases based on how we're brought up. And then you think about perspectives. Well, actually, it's pretty hard if you can stay in that space, honestly, and with presence and on purpose, you're already in a more inclusive leadership space. And then if you can prioritize on that, there might be something in an extension of it to use in that mindset of how can we actually be more inclusive? And that goes into your diversity and things like that, but actually making it more practical. Because our big thing at the minute is all the focus is on inclusivity and diversity. And actually it should just be being an inclusive leader, because if you were an inclusive leader, there would be no issues with anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the 1960s, this, where Robert Greenleaf came out with his servant leadership model about, like, turn the hierarchy upside down. Leaders are not at the top with everyone beneath them making them cups of tea and doing what they're bidding. Actually, they should be underneath everyone else, serving them, making sure they've got what they need to be able to do their job. Yeah. Now, I love this. And again, Patrick Lencioni's latest book, The Motive, it's only just come out. He says, actually, it shouldn't even be a thing, servant leadership. It's just, that's what leaders do. And he's like really passionate and really quite strong about it. And I think if leaders did do that and were more inclusive, you know, I talk a lot about leadership by wandering around, which I stole from Hewlett-Packard in the 1980s and Tom Peters that made it famous. They called it management by wandering around. Like, get on the ground and find out. Lead by literally walking around. And not just leading by walking around, by being on the ground and talking to people and finding out what they need and finding out where they're at. I think there's a couple of really, really big questions. And I think the big questions for us in a COVID world, the first question for me is, just as you are leading by wandering around and you're with your people, and that can be on a Zoom call as well, just saying to them, what do you think?
Mm.
You know, this is something, what do you think? And then shut your mouth and listen. Don't go, what do you think? And the moment they say something that you like, you jump on it. Or some people go, what do you think? And answer the question.
Oh, actually, I've sat in meetings and heard people say that.
Oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable. I'm really, 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 really bothered about what you all think. So here's what I think.
Exactly. And you're like going, if you played that back to yourself before you said that out loud, because it ain't a good look. But I do think genuinely getting leaders to go, what do you think? And shut up and walk around. I mean, Howard Schultz did it. Howard Schultz, CEO of Starbucks, he was visiting like 25 stores a week.
Oh, he totally got it, didn't he? The idea of it being the third space and where that came from, being in the middle of it.
But you know, he was visiting stores. So if Howard Schultz can do it, I think we all can. And again, it's about saying, what do you think? The other one, though, because, you know, thinking is one thing. We're in the world we're living in at the moment. So I've always been passionate. Leadership by wandering around. What do you think? What do you think? Shut up and listen. And people say, yeah, two ears, one mouth in that. And I'm like, no, two eyes, two ears, one mouth, 4-to-1 ratio. Like, shut up, look and listen. Like, really do that thing. But then the more we've got into COVID and the more I've learned, again, snagging this and watching people do it really well, they don't just say, what do you think? They say, how do you feel? They get to that feeling, you know, that passion you talked about earlier when you said, does that draw you toward? Yeah, it does. How do you feel about this? Because if you do then shut up and listen and people aren't really up for it, then don't put them in that place. They're not going to enjoy it. They're not going to be in their strength zone. And you're going to get very frustrated because they ain't going to want to do it. Now, I realise we can't just let people do whatever they want in work. I'm being a realist too here. But I do think those two questions are massive. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think when you think about this and be really quite specific about what you're asking about, rather than just the thought of a how do you feel generally kind of thing, that really gets to people. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier on, I think, about how well you know your people, because if you know them well, you can be more specific because you've got more material to talk to them about, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, I'm probably going a bit deep here, but I'll do it anyway.
Go for it.
I think it links to cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, the cognitive behavioral therapy triangle, which has like thinking, feelings, and actions.
That's
why I think those questions are really important, because you can say to people, what do you think? I want to know your cognition on this. You know, how do you feel? I want to know how you actually feel about this. It matters to me. And the more you do that, the more people trust it. But then what do we do? Those four words, each element of the BBT triangle can really start to get you to know where your team are. And as somebody within that team, wouldn't you love that? I mean, you can see it in great leaders. they're asking these kind of questions. Please don't think I'm trying to come across like I've just had this idea myself. This is stuff. This is stuff I've observed brilliant people like Warren Gatland do. You know, Tony Smith, great, great mate of mine, the rugby league coach. You know, great people like John Clark, who's one of the head of S&C and performance people at England Rugby Union, Paul Strigian over at Wales, Ian Hopkins, chief of police, Greater Manchester. You know, these are great leaders I've been privileged enough to observe and go, you guys get this. Gareth Southgate's another one, actually. I mean, what a great leader, the way he thinks about things and he puts things across. These are smart leaders doing smart things, and they're doing them with their people, not to their people. And that's the Patrick Lencioni stuff. This isn't like a let's do servant leadership because it's a new idea. Well, it was actually around in the 1960s. It shouldn't be a bit of something we do every now and again. It should be what we do all the time.
Yeah. I tell you what, I'm really curious to know. You've talked about a few sporting people there in sporting analogies. Sports coaching has often been around sort of do-it instruction. And I'm interested, sort of recently, have you seen that move away to being a lot more about what are you experiencing when you're doing this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that is down to the press. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've seen hair dryer treatments. I've been elite sports dressing rooms in a number of sports more times than I can possibly care to remember. Like, and that is a huge privilege, by the way. I'm not being flippant. So I've seen a lot of it. And occasionally you get somebody coming and kicking the water bottles. But a lot of that is actually, you know, dramatised up by, you know, the commentator on TV. I wouldn't want to be a fly on the wall in that dressing room at halftime kind of thing. You know, no, the best leaders are smart. They will walk in, they will sit down quietly and they'll say, okay, where are we?
How are we feeling? Yeah, about
what do we think?
This.
Yeah. How do we feel? Yeah. They'll do the pause. Let's have a minute, guys.
Yeah.
So a lot of this I learned from sport. They'll go, whoa. Quieten down. Use the bathroom. Get a drink. Get physio if you need it. Get whatever you need. Sit down. Let's just take a moment, guys. They'll calm it down. And then they'll go, okay, what do we think? How do we feel? Perspectives.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, as a result of this, what do you think we need to do? And it's not about telling, it's about asking.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, a statement made is a question lost. But you'll see this, you know, there's when you see a good leader, it doesn't matter on the sector. When you see a good teacher in the class, they're not telling kids. Da-da-da-da-da. It's not like, you know, it's not like some kind of sergeant major. And they don't do that in the army either. You know, I've been fortunate to share the stage with Colonel Stuart Tuchel, who did the raid into Helmand Province. And he was talking to the troops on the front line. They were coming up with strategy together. I think this kind of 1980s Michael Douglas, pinstripe suit, yeah. Wall Street leadership, you're fired, Sir Alan Sugar stuff. It's kind of gone.
He's good. Yeah,
it's kind of gone now. And I'm not stupid. It will still be there occasionally. And some great leaders will do it occasionally. And by the way, situational leadership, it should come in sometimes, but I think there's too many smart leaders that I've seen over the years that are just so good. And of course, some of those are just brilliant head teachers as well. Yeah. And high ranking police officers.
Yeah. I think there's a reason though, why so much of it and so much business can learn from those sectors that you said. So particularly sport, but totally teachers and the military, is because the gap for the response is so much smaller. Like, you see the output so much quicker. So you talk about the sports thing there, and actually with teachers, you know, when kids move around so much, there's so much energy that as soon as you get them to pause physiologically, there's something that happens so much. I could even say it, you know, it happens. They get that feeling straight away that they calm down. Whereas when you're in business and you're stressed or you're in it, you aren't capable of, I think we forget how to calm ourselves down the older we get. Whereas I think so much of this great coaching stuff comes out of sport and education and the military, is because the body and the mind are so, they're better connected and they're more aware of the relationship. And we're just lucky as business leaders if we can put the two together. Because I think one of the biggest things that adults in the business don't learn, or we get we have to be reminded about is the subject object, where you are been subjected to your emotional state and you aren't able to make an object of it. And you aren't actually be able to go, I'm not in the state now where I'm not capable of making a good decision. You don't, not many people ever admit that, do they? Whereas
No, I think where our business model's different. So this might be very confusing. So I do coaching one-on-one. Mm. And I do some keynotes. And I know some people are like, well, which do you do? The answer is I do both because I enjoy both. I find keynote speaking exhausting, so I limit that. And I do the coaching, and I just adore coaching one-on-one. You can, you know, go anywhere and it's fantastic. But I also do a lot of observations of businesses. And there is quite a few businesses now, more and more actually, because it's a good model, will bring me in once a month to their exec team meeting. And I'll do that in the meeting. I'll be there for the whole meeting. I'll probably have a little input. But then at times I might go, right, what's going on here? What's happening here, guys? Hold on a minute. Well, let's have a tea break. I'm bursting for the toilet. There's ways of like just bringing it down a little bit. So
you're doing the pause for them.
Yeah. But they will give me permission to do that. And it's a really interesting model. I don't know anybody else that does it. There might be people that listen to this, go, I've been doing it for years, Drew. But I've not come across it, but it's so effective. And it's a really good way of taking a team on a journey, particularly if you have some input. But, you know, I've seen some brilliant business leaders, like a lot of business leaders. So there's one guy I work with, and because I've not asked his permission, I won't say his name, but he starts off every meeting going, right, one word, how are we feeling?
Yeah, we've seen that happen, haven't we? Yeah.
And you know what? It was great. There's another guy I was working with recently going, I want you to tell me something fantastic from another member of this team's work, and then I want you to tell me what you're going to do about it.
Yeah.
And that was really cool because they were going, well, okay, I'm going to nominate so-and-so in your team. And they were brilliant at that. And it had a massive impact on us. And they were like, you can see people go, oh, I didn't even know about that. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Oh, wow, that was really good. Yeah, it was really good. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this for them. I'm going to send this through. And it was just so good. I see some brilliant meetings. I see some terrible stuff too. You know, when you first start working with somebody or you turn up and you're just speaking at a keynote and some of the stuff you see, you're like going, oh my goodness, come on guys, we could do better than this. But I see some really smart things happening out there now. People are really thinking about meetings. And I do think people in COVID have had to think about meetings because we're staring at a bloody screen like for hours and hours and hours on end. So people are getting really creative. There was a guy the other day started off a meeting. He was telling me about it, which was genius. He was like, right. And he just picked up a potato and he went, right, everyone, how do you prefer to cook a potato? Best start to a meeting ever. They were just talking nonsense, absolute nonsense, talking about potatoes for the first 10 minutes. But the connect on the meeting will have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So I'm going to move the conversation on a bit. I'm just conscious of time. Given our podcast is called Building Better Leaders, it would be a miss of us to not talk to a teacher about building better leaders of the future. So we're not going to get to, you know, into the ins and outs of education because that's not what we're about as a podcast. But I guess what we're interested in is, how are we equipping our kids to be better leaders of the future? And especially given it's in a world that's only going to get more complex, more uncertain, more ambiguous. If you were granted a magic day where you could almost rewrite the syllabus for education for the next year of students, what would you add into it that you think is missing from a leadership perspective of a future generation of leaders?
God, that would, what a day that would be. For no one else.
It's wonderful though to think.
For no one else but me. No. I mean, there's so many things I could talk about. Like so many things. My great belief and my kind of like real passion about education is just to strip it back. And I've said this on so many forums, but I'm going to say something different about it this time and go the next level down. Because we forget what education's for. Is it to get exam grades? Well, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But is it to prepare people for life? Yes, it is. That's why we brought it in. This is preparing people for life. And in the world we're living in now, how do we prepare people for life? So You would probably expect me to say this, but I believe in three things, and they have to be in order. It's my rule of three. Yeah. They don't all start with the same letter, though.
Oh, don't they? Go on. Oh, I've just
changed it up. The first one does start with P, actually, which is, I think we need to develop young people personally. We need to develop them as people. We need to teach them the skills of things like self-awareness. Now, please, I am not suggesting we're not doing this, but this would be priority number one for me. Teaching them things about where their strengths lie, teaching them about well-being, so that not just like you need to go and do this, actually, here's a toolkit and play around with it of the things that work for you, getting them to know themselves at a higher level. That would be, for me, the number one priority, because we want people to be people who know themselves and know what they're good at and know what they want and know where the pitfalls are and be a good rounded human being, because the characters we have can shift over time, but they're more fixed. And the time that young people are at school, this is when they get fixed. So the priority number one would be that. A couple of great books on this. My good mate, Steve Oakes, has written a book and he uses a model called the VESPA mindset, which stands for vision, effort, systems, practice, attitude. I love that. I think that would be really important to help young people with that. Another good mate, the sumo guy, Paul McGee, he's written a book called Yes, which is all for young people. He's got his sumo principles, but it's for kids. And that's about how the brain works, how we can look at life. So I think it's almost giving them a personal toolkit to survive life. The next element is where I think the leadership stuff would come in. So the first bit is the person stuff, the people stuff, yeah, for them individually. The next bit would be the social stuff, the leadership stuff, the ability to communicate, to listen. You know, really important skills to be able to lead, to manage, to influence, to be part of a team, to show appreciation to others, to be a good citizen. You know, because we want people to be good people, but we want them to go out into the world to be able to be part of the bigger world's ecosystem, play their role, be a good person in society. What does that actually mean? And I think if we get them right as people and we give them those skills to be able to work with other people, on top of that should come the academic. So if you like, it's the PSA, if we're going to take the rule of three and give them letters, it's the personal, the social and the academic. And I've been very passionate about that for a long time, because I think you can't just do the academic and forget the first two. Because if you do, you're going to create people with great sets of exam results, but they can't stand on their own two feet.
Yeah.
Or you might get two of them and they might be able to stand on their own two feet and have great exam results, but you know, they're not socially integrated. They're not a good citizen. That's no good either. And by the way, this is a big ask. And by the way, I'm not suggesting schools don't do this, because I know many of them do. Mm-hmm. But if I was in charge for a day, and it probably would only be a day, I'd be booted out by R3 and probably put on detention as well. But that's what I'd do. I'd make it priority number one is the development of the personal. Priority number two, the social. On top of that, that's when you can do the academic.
The PSA, that's really, really interesting, that, Drew. And, you know, it is a bit of an unfair question, really, because as much as we can pull holes in the current syllabus or certain figureheads in government or people very senior in education, it's just such a mammoth beast and you can never simplify it to know exactly what you do. So thank you for answering that in the way that you have. Now, it's also got me thinking, this PSA, actually, it is going through my mind quite a lot, because I've got a little boy who is two and I'm in my late 30s. So my experience personally of education is very different from how education is today. You know, it was 20, 30 years ago, I was at school. I'm just thinking, as a parent myself, and my child is yet to go to school, but very soon I will no doubt be having to think about what kind of school he goes to, where he goes to school. Do I look at Ofsted? Do I look at teachers? Where do I even start? My question to you is, knowing what you know about education, for me as a parent, what could I do to do the PSA if the school isn't up to it or if the system isn't up to it?
Yeah, I've been asked a lot about this. And you know what's interesting? Even in all my leadership warbling that I do, I was asked to do stuff about homeschooling and home parenting. Because don't forget, school is really important. The parenting is the most important. And studies will back that up time and time again. So it's a really great question. Trusting the system, maybe, maybe not. Trusting the teachers, by and large, absolutely. Mm. And, you know, we're seeing this in the NHS. I am going to come back. I promise I'm not dodging the question. But the NHS system don't work. But my goodness me, the people who work in the NHS system make it work. Mm. So I have a lot of hope. Yeah. I'm an eternal optimist here because I've got friends, heroes of mine who are teachers who are doing an incredible job. So we will find a way of making it work. And I think human beings do that. But yes, parents need to do their bit too. I would say everybody, and these are friends of mine, but I will plug it anyway. I might do something on this myself in the future, I think, because I'm passionate about it. I think everybody should read Carol Dweck's Mindset book and understand growth mindset. It's about the effort.
But not yet.
Whenever I get a report home for my kids, and by the way, I don't know the Ofsted gradings of my kids' schools. I've got no idea. I don't know what exam results they get in my kids' schools. Genuinely, I have no idea. But I go in and I look at those teachers and I go, this is where my kids come in.
Yeah.
I look at the head teacher and go, this is where my kids come in.
That's back to your people first, isn't it, though?
Every time. Every time, John. Every time. But I slightly lost my train of thought there. Where was I going with that?
Rachel was on about do you feel confident in the system?
But what can you do as a parent?
And what can you do?
I'm back in the room. We're all right. I'm back. This is what happens when you've got a brain like mine. It goes all over the place.
I couldn't. So,
mindset, Carol Dweck, when my kids were here being homeschooled or whenever they bring anything back, the first grade I look at is the effort grade. First grade. I don't care what you've got over there at the minute. We'll get to that in a minute. Have you put the effort in? That's all I care about. Because if you put the effort in and you keep putting the effort in, kid, you're going to go somewhere. Effort is number one. And of course, that links to the Dr. Angela Duckworth stuff on grit, where effort counts twice, if you've read that stuff. Yes, I'm going to plug my two guys' book. I think everyone should read the stuff by Steve Oakes on the Vespa mindset. I think that's very important for kids to start owning their own lives, but with huge support. And I think the stuff Paul McGee's done, I know Andy Cope's done some great stuff on the art of being a brilliant teenager. I think the stuff out there that actually helps people to look at how we can work with our young people as parents, because the parents are the biggest difference maker. They really are. And it's how we can work with our kids to help them own their lives. You know, I see a lot of people have asked me questions. Well, I'm locking my kid in the room every night and I'm taking the phone and I'm doing this and I'm going, that's great. But when you're not there, what's going to happen? We need to get kids to own this themselves. We've all seen it, haven't we, right? We all went to school with someone whose parents locked them away and then they locked them away for A-levels and then they went off to university and were hanging upside down every day. They didn't go to any lectures. They just got smashed. They were literally just parted for the whole of their degree because they didn't own it. And I think there's something about life is let's work with our young people to own this now. You know, I'm not going to ban my kids off stuff unless I really have to. And people might not agree with that. They might think I'm running some kind of hippie commune at our house. But I think it's about saying, you know, when something goes wrong, what do you think you should get as a punishment for that? How long do you think you should be on your mobile phone? Bearing in mind, I might show them a bit of research. What do you think you should watch? And actually getting them to take control of their lives and own it themselves, take responsibility. I think that, for me, that's what I would encourage parents to do. My parents certainly did that with me. We can't live our kids' lives for them. And if we do, it's going to be very dangerous when they're not under our watchful eye.
Drew, that you will be saying to your kid, look, here are your choices. What do you actually want to do? Because effectively, that happened to me when I'm bringing my eldest up. He had the choice to go to a grammar school or go to a school where all his mates were going. And he wanted to go to the school where all his mates went to. And in the end, I took the decision, rightly or wrongly, to let him decide.
Yeah.
He got his qualifications and he enjoyed his school life. So, you know, that sits fairly easily with me, but you know, is it always the case? I don't know.
It's hard. It's a hard one because you will get kids, you know, going, well, I'm picking that school because of my mates. I'm picking these GCSE subjects because my mate's doing it. Are you any good at it? No. Do you like it? No. Why are you doing it? Because my mate's doing it. It's like one of those ridiculous conversations you have with kids. But I do think young people can make really smart decisions. Absolutely. If we give them the opportunity to do it, sometimes we go, well, they're not capable of doing that. And that is a bit like we can see from leaders as well. Oh, well, we best not ask the front line because they don't understand the machinations of what we deal with in it. Well, actually, they do. And young people are, like, I love spending time with young people. My own lads, I've got a 17-year-old, I've got a 12-year-old, I've got a 9-year-old. And they will teach me things all the time. Mm-hmm. They'll pull me up short all the time. My son this morning said, what's wrong with you? I was like, I don't know why, what's wrong with you? And he said, oh, you just look a bit grumpy. I was like, oh, sorry, kind of thing, you know. And that's not, he wasn't being rude. I know he was doing it out of a place of caring. I think our kids can teach us a lot. And sometimes we try and make the decisions for them. And sometimes we have to do that. But again, helping them see and bringing them part of the conversation, I think is the biggest help we can give them because that's part of their development. They've got to wrestle with these life decisions.
We talk a lot about the socialized mindset, don't we? The Robert Keegan work and Jennifer Garvey Berger. And I wonder if there is a place in schools or for younger people, if they were aware of what the socialized mindset is and the fact that it's a rite of passage and actually that what your mates think is a natural progression of how your brain evolves. But actually, you don't know that's what's happening to you when you're in it. And actually, maybe if that was explained to you. But I think a lot of that and not talking about that is what perhaps leads us to things like the bystander effect, you know, when you see bully, you know, because you're not given the tools as a young person, you know, explain what you're feeling when something feels uncomfortable.
Yeah,
because you've got to deal with the behavioural issue or the thing that's gone wrong or the incident that happened in school. And actually, do we take time to go, well, what just happened to you and how, because you just saw it, you weren't involved in it, but how the rest of the group handles that, I think is a big thing that perhaps we still deal with the repercussions of in a lot of the cultural work we do in organisations, because people don't know how to handle the bystander effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're almost like the kid going, well, where's the adult who's going to come and sort it out?
Nobody told them off, so that was okay. And then it becomes what we call an undiscussable, because it wasn't corrected or talked about. Yeah. It then becomes something in the culture you can't talk about.
Yeah.
So I know we've gone off on a bit of a tangent then from talking about what parents can do, but I think this is interesting stuff. So let's bring it back on track. This podcast is called Building Better Leaders. What would your advice be and what would your tips be for leaders in organisations today for how they can develop and build potential in their new recruits and in the young people that are just joining their organisations today? How can they build better leaders within their own organisation?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. There's a number of things that I think that would be useful. One of the biggest ones is give them loads of experience. Like, we're living in an experience world now. You know, we experience so much. And I think getting people to experience different parts of a business, working with somebody and getting them to see what they've got to do, I think would be really important. Because what can happen is, you know, with the modern mindset of the new generations coming into the workplace, they're kind of going, well, we want to get up there. We want to get involved in this. And actually, they might not understand what that looks like. So my view is get them up there and let them see it. Just let them experience it. We live in the experience economy anyway. And they're expecting, you know, they're always about the experience of everything. You know, we don't just you know, buy something online anymore. There's a whole, you know, wraparound experience from Amazon, or when we're buying new Apple products, there's a whole wraparound experience of what you get there. I think giving people a variety of experiences would be crucial, because then they can start to connect the dots themselves and see the bigger picture, rather than coming in wanting to kind of get involved in everything straight away.
Yeah, because you apply for a job, don't you? You get the role, and there you are, in you're put into that box, if you like. And if you're not allowed to see elsewhere, there could be something that you'd be infinitely better at and enjoy way more.
Yeah.
Yet you could never see, because you couldn't see over the walls, you know. And you always think that that's such a shame, isn't it?
And I think it'd be good. I think it'd be really good for retention, because I think some people get a job and go, well, I don't have to stay in here. I only keep a job for 2 years. I'm brassed off here. I'm not enjoying it. I'm off. Where in actual fact, if they saw another part of the business going, listen, this is all right here, well, that is what I was born to do. Boom. Well, we'll work towards getting you in that place. Yeah. So I think giving people a variety of experience and letting them try different things, because the whole job market is changing. You know, yeah. Work is not like it was. Adding COVID, it's definitely not what it was. So we've got to give people the opportunity to kind of suck it and see.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. Any other questions?
Good tip is that, really.
Yeah.
No, so I thought what we'd probably wrap up with, really, Drew, would be your three leadership essentials.
My three leadership essentials. This is a whole other podcast. You do realise that, don't you? Never short of a few words. Okay, I'm going to do it as quick as I can. Leaders have got to be learners. Full stop. They've got to keep reading. They've got to get better. Don't stand still. We have a phrase over here. We say, you stand still, you'll get left behind.
Mm.
The Americans have a phrase, if you stand still, you'll get run over.
I think it's important, that, though, because lots of leaders think that they do know it all.
Yeah, well,
and you get that sort of command and control, do as I say, not do as I do sort of thing. And they don't want to expand their own minds, because I think in many respects they really do believe that they know it all.
Well, I think, yeah, I wonder whether that's a bit of imposter syndrome being masked by reverse psychology. I know I just said a lot in that one sentence, but I think that there's probably a little voice inside that says, well, if you make out that you do,
people think you do.
I disagree with that, but I think a lot of them don't have time, and I think you need to make time to be constantly learning. I think it needs to be a
well, you see, I know, but when I say learning, people go, oh, you're going to go on a course, or you're going to read a book. And yeah, that is absolutely useful. But what about learning a bit about yourself, going, what the hell did I just, again, getting curious, what the hell did I just do that for? And by the way, what the hell did you just do that for? And actually, what that was really good. What the hell did we do that for? I think there's a lot of stuff where we don't learn enough about situations. We're not observational. I mean, I know it's easier for me to do, and it's kind of how my mind works, but there's learning all around us every day. Even in this podcast, I've learned a load of things that I'd not even connected in my own head before, some things I hadn't even thought about. And it's always about having a mindset of being open. And if you've got an open mind, you know, it's a bit like that quote about a parachute, isn't it? That, you know, parachutes only work
when like open. A parachute, it works best when open.
That was it. I cocked that up, didn't I? Well done, though, for you getting it right. A star. Top of the class. I think there's an awful lot about learning. Don't stand still. Keep going. And the other thing that people forget about learning, the more competent we become, or at least competent we feel we've become, the more confident we'll become.
Mm.
So keep learning. If you're a leader, learn about your craft. Love that thing. Learn about yourself. Learn about others. Learn about situations. Learn about the sector. Learn outside the sector. It's on all the time. When I watch a football match on TV, I am really interested in what the coaches are saying before it and after it, because I'm learning about leadership right there and then. I do it all the time. I'm really interested, even on communication. I'm a celebrities on at the moment, and I love the way that Ant and Dec do their communication. It's cool because they have a really good way in the timing of the communication and their over communication of what there's learning everywhere. Open your eyes, open your ears, and soak it up.
Number two
would have to be responsibility. I think leaders just have to own things. John Maxwell says the most important ability is responsibility. Too often, again, I have seen quite a bit of this in all sectors. People blame, the blame game, or they make excuses. You know, I do like Jurgen Klopp, but I'm an Everton fan, so it's a nice opportunity for me to slag him off a bit here. He once blamed the wind because they lost the game.
Yeah.
And I was like, give over. I don't know whether it was a joke, but, you know, some people can blame, they make excuses, or they become a bit, no, own it. You know, you took the job on. And I have been next to coaches who've lost their jobs. I've been with exec leaders when they've been given the bullet. I've obviously experienced that. And people go, oh, it's awful, it's awful. And people are lovely and you're going, thank you for your comments. But if you're a leader, that can happen to you. Yeah. So just own it. You know, we again, I'm going to quote John Maxwell. Leaders want the perks, but sometimes they're not willing to pay the price. And the responsibility of leadership is if something goes wrong, you have to own it. You might not have done it. It might not be your fault, but it is your responsibility.
So, Drew, you must love Bielsa then at Leeds.
Love him.
He does absolutely own it.
He never
comes out and says that were that player's fault. I picked the team, my decision, wrong structure, wrong formation, whatever.
Also, what happened when they got that goal that they shouldn't have got? He let the other team score.
Yeah.
He just owns everything. Yeah. And why is it that Pep Guardiola and Pochettino and all these managers are like, he's God.
Yeah.
He's God. I mean, he's not really that well known. He's not really, you know, one of the great, but everyone loves him. And there's something about, I think, the person that stands up there and goes, yeah, it might not have been fair, but guess what? Life's not fair. And guess what? I came into this to take this leadership role on with my eyes wide open. Mm. I'm not complaining. I'm not doing any of that. I'm owning it. I'll take responsibility. Yeah. It's on me.
And number three,
you're going to think I'm soft and sappy when I say this. Leaders cannot care enough. We need more care in the world. We need more kindness. And it's not just because of COVID. Care for me is massive. The old adage, no one cares what you know until they know that you care. People need to know you care about the business. People need to know you care about the work. People need to know you care about them. Because if people know that you care, deep down, you give a damn about these people, then they'll pretty much do anything for you.
Yes. Yeah.
It's such an important bit of leadership. And you won't hear that many people talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just give a damn. Yeah. Give a damn about what you're doing. And don't be afraid to show people you give a damn. Show your passion. Show you're bothered. It's great. It's great to see. It's great to see someone that's really fired up with that passion. And people will follow people through a wall of fire for that.
I think they're wonderful.
They are.
Really amazing leadership essentials. And actually, just rules for life, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the hardest person you ever lead is yourself.
Yeah.
That's it.
And if I can learn, I can take responsibility for where I am and I can care as much as I can, well, I think I've led myself pretty well.
Yeah. Well, very much so.
On that note, I think we'll leave it there because that's a pretty good high. Thank you so much for your time. I think this has been our longest podcast to date. You did say it would be a long one. You speak incredibly well, so thank you for that. We've learned a lot, haven't we?
Well, I think for all of us, you've mentioned an awful lot of people there. You quoted a lot of people who you've read or certainly listened to the audio version of. And I think, you know, if you are listening to this podcast, what we will do is I think we'll pick out a few of those people and we'll put it into the show notes, Drew, so that people have got an easy reference because they'll be interested in following up and learning a little bit more about it.
And we talked a lot about your 3 P's model. We will put a link to the Forbes article in there, which it's well worth a read for anybody listening to this. But also, let's not forget your book as well.
There's a new blog coming out this weekend as well on leadership language in a remote world. And some of that is about what do you think. So
Wonderful.
I'll give you a link to that as well.
Yeah, give us a link. Perfect. We'll put it in the show notes.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching.